Wow. And in conclusion, I must have given a hell of a talk. That was a round of applause I haven't had for a while. Thank you. Enthusiasm, God within, obviously, in this room anyway. Anybody here from Oklahoma? I didn't think you'd admit it. Talk about outside issues, huh? Well, anyway. I haven't seen this enthusiastic a group since I told my wife I was leaving one time. It was my mother-in-law and her. They were quite happy about the whole thing. So, anyway, we're still together. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. And I have no idea what you've done to deserve this. You had David C. from Tennessee booked for tonight. And apparently he's so old that his group is having a birthday and he's the only surviving member, so he couldn't come. See? So, like, I don't know what you've done, but you've got me. And I'm going to share with you to the level of my understanding, which some of you are going to say, well, keep coming back. Whatever I say tonight is not directed at any single person. And if you're in here tonight and you have a heavy load, you know, and you just don't want to have any fun, I'm sorry about that. If I offend you, I mean to. But what I would hope to do tonight is not offend anyone. I would just hope to share my experience. Some of the stuff, like my little book report, that's what this is about. I'm not here some hotshot intellectual AA speaker sent from God, you know. I'm a drunk, and it's my responsibility to give my book report when I'm requested to do so. And so if there's anything that you can take from that, then I'm a lucky person, because it's by giving away that I get to keep it. See? And the other thing about this is Dave is a southern gentleman, you know, like he's got one of these real nice, soft southern. I'm a Canadian, eh? So, like, you're gonna hear A instead of these soft southern tones. The thing that always makes us laugh in Canada is when, particularly northern people from the States will come and say, "You guys always say A, huh?" First time I ever went to Texas, I said, "Good day, eh? I'm Marty J. I'm AA, eh?" They're sitting there going, "What the hell did he say?" What? Even after you talk, they say, "I got to get a tape. I can't listen that fast." What the hell did he say? So anyway, that's a long way around to say hi, but my name is Marty Jeffrey, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, a sponsor that did not understand rejection. And because love works, I haven't had to have a drink or a mind-altering chemical or anything like that since February the 8th of 1976. I was a prenatal alcoholic. I had my last drink of alcohol when I was 22 years old. And some of you in the room might think that you're 22 and pretty slick and you know, too young to be alcoholic and everything. I thought that too. And if you hate the speaker tonight, so did I when I went to my first conference. So welcome. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship. We don't have any presidents or anything. In fact, this is the only organization in the world where they tell you, you know, there are no dues or fees, and then they pass a hat. Did that screw you up when you first went? It did me. You know, they say, "We'll give you a little job, and as soon as you understand it, then we'll rotate you off that committee." Because everything in Alcoholics Anonymous has got to work upside down and backwards, or we wouldn't stay here. How many people are not alcoholic in this room tonight? Oh. Well, welcome. And if there's anything I say that doesn't make any sense, good. You know. And if it makes a hell of a lot of sense to you, join a group. We suffer from a strange mental twist here, you know. Like, That was one of the big revelations early in my sobriety, was that drinking was not the thing that drove me crazy. I was crazy sober. The drinking went really well. It was those long periods of the pressure building up that used to drive me crazy. And I would do goofy things, you know. Because I was mad all day. I was born just like sort of with an attitude, and you hear speaker after speaker say this, it didn't fit. I can't describe it to you better than some of the thoughts I had when I was 9 years old, sitting in my bedroom. I hadn't had a drink yet. Now, I needed one, but I hadn't found this stuff yet, see? And I was thinking about jumping off the roof of the house onto the patio to show them. So they will be sorry when they see me, my nose just all over the sidewalk. Then they'll know what they've done. And I could see the funeral. Them all saying, boy, we should have been better to him when we had him. Almost Eleanor at that point, wasn't I? Hello? Oh, I know. I've got teenagers now that go out and I stand in her spot where she used to wait for me. You know. I was loved, but incapable of understanding what that was about. I was from a Christian home, you know, a breeding ground for alcoholism. My mother and father had no concept of this illness. Just none. We had an uncle. Uncle Sam. Shh. Uncle Sam. He drank, you know. And he'd get terribly drunk, and he'd smash his house up and that. We didn't talk about that in the family. It was the big secret. Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam used to get drunk and one eye would go closed, you know. And he'd always talk about, he was in the Second World War, in the Army. But when he was drunk, he used to talk about being in the Navy. Oh, God, it was rough, you know. Mud up to here, blood up to here. And I thought, man, if I drink, I will never drink like Uncle Sam. That's one thing I knew. I was sober about 2 years, and my wife said to me, you know, the one thing that really just used to bother me when you drank was when that one eye would go closed. The Uncle Sam story says a couple of things. First of all, why wouldn't he say he was in the Army? Because drunks will lie even when the truth is good enough. You know, when I was a couple of years sober, somebody said, I saw you in Safeway. I said, no, you didn't. I wasn't in Safeway. But I was. And then I left and I thought, why did I lie about that? And what I figured out was I just didn't want anybody to know where I was at any particular time in case I decided to do something wrong. That is the mind of the alcoholic. Cunning, baffling, and baffling. Well, anyway, so my parents had no precognizance of alcoholism. They did not understand anything about it, and I was about to erupt. I had problems in grade 6. They handed around a form and it said religion. Okay. So I'm trying to remember, are we Protestants or prostitutes? I wasn't even trying to be a smart guy. I mean, I really honestly had the words mixed up, you know, like I just had heard about prostitutes. So I wrote on the form prostitutes. And, spent the first of many, many days out in the hall. Learning resentment. Taking posters off the wall and re-putting them up so when the principal went by, he'd say, yeah, what are you doing that again? Oh, yeah, I'm, you know, class monitor, you know. You learn how to survive when you're a drunk, right? I went out one night in grade 6 with a little buddy's. And he was my best friend. You know how that goes when you're in grade 6? Like it's almost one. You know, you're united. And his daddy had got this bottle of Loganberry wine. Oh, some of you ended up on this stuff, man. I started with it. I think Loganberry wine should be mentioned in the second appendix on spiritual experience. It was incredible. And this is the most incredible substance on earth because it goes down this dark purple, but when it comes up, foamy pink. It's yes. And it floats on water like Dream Whip. It's incredible. You know, and after a period of time, you can blow it right over your own head. Like, so, see, we got in this hot, hot bathroom, and I think you should start drinking somewhere classy. Because that's where you're going to end up. There's no use screwing around. You might as well get right at it. He took a honk of this stuff and went, "Poo! Yuck!" I'm narrow-eyed, like, hmm. Well, I took some of it, and I learned how to laugh in French immediately. Like, And I'm starting to think, why do I hang around with this guy? I don't think I like him anymore, right? Immediately, they said, "Did you change companionship?" "Oh, yeah." By about the third drink. And I went through that thing that you all went through if you're an alcoholic. That where my fear was changed to aggression. Like, I had no more missing pieces. I was humming. Onto the bicycle. Into the back of a truck. And it didn't hurt. And I thought, I'll go beat my brother up. That's what I'll do. Little skin donation, no big problem. The rest of the way home. My mother opens the door and there it is. Baptized in Loganberry wine and blood. Bleeding, beat up, bruised, happy. She said, what has happened to you? And I said, I don't want to talk. You know, what I was thinking, of course, was a couple of drinks after work. You know, nothing serious. And then I went in there and she took my clothes off of me and threw me into a bathtub to humiliate me, you know, like the normies do when they can get a good moment with you, right? Well, I just covered the top of the water with that foamy Loganberry wine. There's... And I'd like to tell you that part of me floated to the top, but it didn't, you know. And my brothers were brought in, and this taught them a hell of a lesson for life. They're both in AA now. Oh, it was incredible. I went up to my room, and I had my first out-of-body experience. You know, you put one foot on the floor to stop the rotation of the entire earth. Oh, man, I got to school, and I was sick. And I had scraped my face all up, and both my knees were scraped up, and my mother was furious. My father had kicked my butt. I'd been humiliated in front of my brothers, and I said, "Oh, I love this stuff." I had the best night of my entire life last night. Of course, the other grade six kids are going, "Huh?" You know, quit hanging around with them. Because we didn't have anything in common anymore. You know, almost simultaneous to this, I noticed that the girls in grade six don't have any boobs. I mean, you grow up. It changes the way you are in every area of your life. And it's a rapacious creditor. Rapacious creditor. It takes you against your will. And right then, the payoff was so high, I didn't care what I was going to have to pay or how much a little bit of pain I was going to stand or any of those things. Didn't care. Now, I could have gone to Alcoholics Anonymous immediately, right? But can you imagine in my little town in 1963, the year that Kennedy was assassinated, I drank over that. You know, I was so sad over that. I never thought of that right until this moment, but they would never say that a kid in grade six could be alcoholic. It was ridiculous. But I was. And you see, you have taught me that this illness moves in different ways in different people, and that it's just like being diabetic. I mean, some kids are diabetic, and some adults don't become diabetic until they're well into their adult lives. And so it is with alcoholism. So I was instant. My physical being was immediately addicted to alcohol. Now, spiritually, I had a period of time left. Mentally, I had a period of time left. And you know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, on page 34, it says that when we get here, our need for spiritual things is in direct proportion to how bad we are physically. You can read all about it. See, if I'm badly addicted and I'm in really rough shape, and I'm going to need spiritual things right now. But if I come bumping into AA, as Bill says, you know, with just the first snap of the ringer, I might be an Alcoholics Anonymous for a period of time, oh, say, 6-7 years, and then the entire world falls apart because it's time to do the spiritual work that we haven't done. And that happened to me too. By the time I was a teenager in high school, I was in rebellion with everybody and everything. And I used to spend my time thinking about how I would like to get you. I didn't have relationships. I had hostage takings, and I had angry, you know, you do this for me or you don't love me kind of relationships. Everything was on a string, and I, of course, at this period of my life, found myself somebody who later became a member of Al-Anon, because they were looking for a lunatic just like me. And let me tell you something, you Al-Anons. From vast experience, I've been all over these countries. Every time one of you gets rid of one of us, you go out and get another one just like us. So it's no use, keep the damn one you got and get them fixed. It took my wife nearly 20 years to get me straightened out, but she says, I'm coming. When I started to realize some of the things that were happening, when I was with a friend and we were drunk on vodka, and I remember he brought this revolver out and he said, I bought this gun, blow my head off. And I said, well, get at it, let's do it, you know. Because when you're young and you're alcoholic, death is abstract and consequences are. I mean, how many times have you rolled cars drunk and walked away and said, I mean, in French, right? Come on. And you start saying, I am invincible. And it's like you get newcomers and I'll say, yeah, I know. If I wouldn't have been drunk when I fell down the stairs, I'd have got hurt. And you try and remind them, if you wouldn't have been drunk, you wouldn't have fallen down the stairs. Yeah. Ooh. Clint put the gun to his head and he blew his head off. Bang! First big time consequence I suffered. Shocking. I took a little LSD at the same time just to see if I couldn't get into myself a little more. I mean, I was only quantum selfish. I wanted to completely implode, you know. There's nothing worse than the character disorders I have and then going on acid too, so you can really look at what a bonehead you are, you know. Oh, God. And kids are celebrating the 60s. Why? It was unbelievable grief and impact. And then immediately denial. It wasn't anything to do with me, you know. And I mean, then the consequences, it just seemed like every time I drank, I was starting to pay a ticket. A rapacious creditor. Taking it back. And I got to the point where I wasn't eating anymore. And I'm 17 years old and I'm back in my mother and father's house because my father had taken me to the door and he said, I don't want to ask you to leave. I'll just point. Go and whip the world, Marty. You know everything. Go before you forget everything about everything. Go and get them, son. See? They'd lost communication. Like when you're a drinking drunk like I am, people say one thing, I hear something else. People used to say, we're having a party, why don't you come over? I heard them say, look, don't bring any liquor. We want you to drink ours. And then later on tonight, if you don't mind, could you smash all our furniture? Like, would you mind? I mean, could you just get pukey drunk and then make a move on my wife? Would you mind? I mean, and when you're sober, it's difficult to hear what they're saying. They say, I care, and you say, what do you want? No, 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 I care. I know what you're saying, what do you want? Because caring and want are tantamount when you're an active alcoholic like I was. I never did anything for fun and for free until you people warped me beyond my wildest dreams. I went home at the age of 16. These are the ridiculous things you do. My father was the toughest guy in my hometown, and I mean by far. I saw him give a man a spanking in a beer parlor one night. Not a beating, a spanking. I'd been drinking with my buddies, and somebody had a fight with their father, and it was a big deal, and I thought, hey, yeah, I'll go and beat my dad up. Good idea. And I went home, and there he was sitting in his chair, and my brother Paul was on the Chesterfield. And I walked up to him, and I said, get up. And he said, excuse me. I said, get up. So he got up, and I give him one of those. He said, you have got to be kidding. Now I'm insulted. So I take another swing, and he, just as polite as anything, just kind of give me a little rabbit punch, like this. Down I go. I get up. He gives me another one. Down I go. Look, my nose is still swollen from this. Jeez. Third time he hits me, I go down. My brother leans forward and says, stay down. So, such a nice man, you know. He went to the door and he told my friends, he said, Marty's sick. He's not going to be coming back out. I didn't go out for 5 days. He broke my nose. Both my eyes were black. And he just carried me to bed. Put me in bed and said, you know, like Marty, at my funeral, stay away from the coffin. I'll still give you a licking. Where do you file this when you're a parent? Like, what is wrong with this kid? Why is he doing these stupid things? My mother looked at my father-in-law. He's an animal for beating me up. What was he supposed to do? If he would have spanked me, I never would have forgiven him. I would have gladly taken the beating. You know, I mean, when I told it in the beer parlor 5 or 6 days later, it was like, oh, he was up, I was up, he was down, I lost, but it was close. You know? So, I mean, I had lost contact, and I came home from this horrible experience. I couldn't even speak it to anyone. And I at 17 years old, I was 127 pounds and 6 feet tall. I hadn't eaten for I don't even know how long. I was in the radio television business, and I used to work all night, and I mean, everything I got, I drank. And I was sick. Real sick, and I can't imagine what they went through. I have no earthly idea. I remember them pulling me out of dead sleeps and saying, Marty, you know, like you're supposed to be on the air. They're calling for you. They'd driven from their hometown to the city I was working in and got me out of bed 3 hours late. It was crazy. And they tried to understand, and I couldn't hear what they were saying. All I could hear was that they were one more time trying to control me. And it was for self-control that I fought. See? People would have you believe in alcoholism that my obsession was to drink. Well, nothing could have been farther from the truth. I never, and some of you may have done this, every time I got drunk, I went out not to get drunk. I always say, you can tell an alcoholic, he's the one unconscious on his feet, you know. And if you blew on him, he'd fall over. But looking good, you know. Cigarette burns right up to the knuckles. See, I had this obsession every time I drank. It was this time I'm going to just drink until I get that hum, and then I'll stop. See, I'm just gonna drink until the fear stops, and I can get that translated into some aggressive behavior, and then I'll stop. And then the phenomenon of craving would start when I drank. A mental change would take place. It says that we have a strange mental blank spot that we can't bring into our minds. With sufficient force, the suffering and the humiliation of even a week or a month before, we are defenseless against the first drink. See, strange how that would work. Because the last time I went drinking was like many, many times I went drinking. I went there not to get drunk. I went there to have a few drinks because I had gotten in a whole bunch of trouble the night before. And I had done the alcoholic national prayer, you know, God, and I mean this time God, buddy, chucker, if you get me out of this mess, I promise, I will never drink again. And this was a really messy mess. It was one of those ones I saw no way of getting clear of. Those of you that live with us and work with us have been amazed before at the messes that alcoholics can get out of. It is almost spiritual. Some of the stuff we get ourselves into and get a parking ticket. You know, other people would be in jail for the rest of their lives. Not alcoholics. We get a parking ticket. And we're mad about it. When I came to that morning, the phone was ringing and it was my stupid sister. And she had another one of her stupid questions. How are you? Well, right now, Lori, to tell you the truth, I think I'm going to die. Does that answer your question, dear? And would you please get the hell off the phone so I can go back and die? And she said the most amazing thing I had ever heard in my life. It had never occurred to me. She said, "Do you think you have a drinking problem?" Where did she get this stuff, I'm thinking? She'd been to a seminar or something? Well, I said, "I don't know whether I got a drinking problem or not, Lori. Like, I got a lot of trouble right now. I really don't need to be on the phone. I got some things I got to sort out." She said, "Would you talk to somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous?" I thought, I have got enough trouble. Now I've got to help somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, geez, I'll talk to them. You know, we're living in a matchbox. We've got nothing. I am hanging by a thread at my place of work. I am scared every minute of every day. I hate the woman I've married. I just hated her because she was so good and I was so bad. I used to tell people it's like living with a porcelain doll. And if she would only get down in the dirt with me, we could have a relationship. Thank God she didn't. Thank God she raised our kids so well and she just did what she did and stood her ground and never ever came into that slime hole I called life. Thank God. And I mean that. Thank God. The day was unbelievable. It was incredibly bad. I went to work and I had gotten drunk and gone to a staff party. Like, these things don't mix. And I had taken a pizza and I had shoved it into the face of the president of the company. Which was funny, by the way. Looking back, it was. But, I mean, to him, no. You know, and I'm in the car thinking, touchy, touchy, touchy. It's okay for everybody else to get a pizza in the face. Why not him? You know. I'd gotten in trouble with one of the girls at the station. I had smashed my car up. This was an incredible experience. It was one of these ones where I got out of the car to beat the guy up. Because, like, I'd had enough of this. I walk over to the car and I throw the door open. It's empty. It's parked. And I thought to myself, lucky for him. It was a bad night. Just a bad... And you know, the most mysterious part of it to me was that only two nights before I had gotten drunk and gotten in a bunch of trouble and had sworn I was never going to do that again. And somewhere around the second or the third drink, it didn't matter anymore. And I thought, oh, who's going to stop me? See? That's the problem with trying to stay sober on your will. If you have the will to be good, it will win on some days because you have a powerful will if you're alcoholic. But if you have a will to do what you want, that will win some days. And so some days you're here and some days you're there and you're making these promises and you really mean them because you're on this side of your will. And then boom, you're over here. You're surprised. They're surprised. They're calling you a liar. Me? I meant it. I broke out drunk, honey. I'm allergic to it. I didn't mean to get drunk again. And yet this mystery thing would set in and all of a sudden there I was. And so one more time, I'm in the president of the company's office. And I got to understand that I had soaked the TV announcer down live on the 11 o'clock news drunk. I had slept on the roof of the station. I had humiliated that business in every possible way, but everybody thought it was like stunts, radio stunts. It wasn't. It was active alcoholism. And he told me he was getting damn sick of my artistic streak. I'm an alcoholic, you know. Why didn't he just say it? See? The guy that had fired me, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous at the radio station I had worked at before, well, he didn't really fire me. We mutually agreed. He said, your last few days here have been your last few days here. And we mutually agreed that I should go and do something else. But he never fired me. There's a big difference when you're alcoholic. That's why we have those resumes and have those big blank spots in them, you know. We're always capable at any point in our sobriety or our drinking career within 3 minutes of being any business to understand exactly what's wrong and knowing how to fix it. That is alcoholism. Or as my sponsor says, alcoholism is the ability to use up a month's supply of anything in 1 hour. The president of the company told me that was that. The next time, young fella, we are going to have to do something. Like, I can't let you humiliate me like this. I agreed. Told him I was wrong. See, when we're sober, we have remorse. If you're in the room tonight and you're new and you want to check it out and see whether you're alcoholic or not, we're the only people in the world that sit on the edge of the bed in the morning regretting things we don't know happened. Phoning people and apologizing only to find out we weren't at their place. We have deep regrets for things we didn't do. And it's big. You know, everything's big when you're alcoholic. I would never solve my problems. Why would I do that when the world has all these problems I really need to solve? Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate, seemingly without provocation, but invariably we find that we set it in motion in the first place. This was my experience that day. I had a guy come down the hallway and tell me he was going to drop the charges. I didn't know I had any charges. Well, I was mad at him for that. Snotty guy didn't even explain what I'd done. So you can imagine my surprise after everything was done and quiet, sitting in the library of that radio station, thinking to myself, did I tell God I will never drink again? Or did I tell God I would never drink again to excess? See, then I started to think, God, oh yeah, yeah, Christ, Christ's first miracle. Yeah, this is alcoholic logic. Christ's first miracle, he turned water into wine. The Lord wants us to drink. Now, he doesn't want us to drink stupid like happened to me all the time, but not like that. I'm not going to do that anymore. Going to be different today. And I start over to the same pub it started in just a little while before, and as I'm walking across the street, a bus goes by. And on the side of the bus is one of those big billboards. And pictured in this billboard is a little boy in bed with a baseball hat sideways and his catcher's mitt. And you can tell it's the same old thing. The old man hasn't come home. And the heading on the ad said, a few drinks after work with the boys, what does it cost? And I thought, man, that is so sad. I had a little boy at home. I was walking over to go get drunk. I looked at that billboard and I thought, how could anybody do that to their kid? And you say to us, we lie to you? I mean, when we admit we're alcoholic, it's then unanimous. But it's news to us. You see, I had no slight clue. And so when my sister said, would you see Alcoholics Anonymous? I thought, whatever. Whatever. And this is when God sent this Norwegian into my life. Now, there are certain parts of the country where you can tell Norwegian jokes, and then there are still places that lynch. But this guy, I was just with him this morning, in fact. He has just become one of my just dearest friends. His name is Dwayne. And you know, at the time I thought Dwayne was about 6'5", 250 pounds. Well, he's only about 6 feet tall, maybe 240 pounds. I was exaggerating, you know. But he came to my house and he walked up to me and he said, I understand you drink even when you're not thirsty. This is what I need, right? I haven't got enough trouble. God has sent me an alcoholic comedian. we go in his car, which was a 1976 Ford LTD. Like, he didn't park it, he docked it at the front of the house. Big car! He's got a brush cut. I had long hair. Okay, this was a while ago, I know that. In fact, hair is awful. Don't you wish everybody would just get it the hell off the top of their heads? We get in this car. Now, this guy's a mystery to me because I don't know where this conversation's going. Dwayne performed a classic 12-step call because he shared a few humorous experiences out of his past. The book tells us to do that in the chapter, Working with Others. And I thought, what has this got to do with the lecture that I'm going to endure here about my drinking and the wages of sin and my sister? And he said that he had broken a train in half one time to go and get drunk. He was on the railroad and broke it in half and drove his car through, and half of the train went missing and just about killed a bunch of people, and talked about putting a car on the tracks and letting it go and going to the beer parlor and catching it at another town. And I thought, see, I couldn't remember any of the crazy stuff I'd done. None of it. So I didn't know if I could help him or not. But as these stories went, I became more and more convinced that I was glad he was getting help. See, love is nothing to do with possession or jealousy or anything. You've taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous that love is when all you have in your heart is concern for the other human being's spiritual condition. That's it. That's it. That's why we don't work on newcomers. We work with newcomers, guys. We just care about their spiritual progress. And you see, so Dwayne had no view of this ugly face that I turned to him. He just cared about getting me okay. And he loved me back. He loved me. I'd never had this happen before. Everybody else had strings and conditions, and if you'd do this, we'd do that, and if you do this, none of that. And at the end of the night, he said, look it, let me ask you a simple question. He said, I'm not going to say you're alcoholic, because nobody should say anybody else is alcoholic. Let me ask you this, though. Do you think that you would get in any trouble at all if you didn't drink? Oh, dirty question. Because I knew that this trouble and drinking somehow were related. I tend to break out in trouble when I've been drinking. And I thought, oh, well, okay, good point, you got a point. All right, now go home. He said, would you come to a meeting with me in the morning? See, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a phony poop, right? I'd love to go to a meeting. Yes. He said he'd pick me up at 10 o'clock. I left at 9. He was in the car waiting for me. Yep. Not only was he in the car waiting for me, but he also was confused as to how he'd got the time wrong. And you immediately start to suspect her. Anyway, we go to this meeting, and I love to tell this story because if you're new, this might make some sense to you. If you've been around for a while, maybe think back with me. But I go in this room, and remember, none of this happened. This is just how I remembered it. We go into this restaurant, and I'm apologizing to people as we go through. There's a meeting in the back room, you see, and I'm saying, like, I'm not in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just going to look. And finally, he comes over to me and says, would you knock it off? You're embarrassing me, you know? Oh, of course. I know what I'm doing. So we go in this room. Everybody in the room's like 100. At least 100. And they've got these big, fat stomachs that they call serenity pouches. And every single one of them has at least got some shares in the Nabob Corporation because they could have sprayed it down their throats with garden hoses. I had never seen anybody consume coffee like these people could drink coffee. You know. And then they're watching to see if anybody's bringing more. You know, it was like, they're all talking about different things at the same time and nodding agreement every once in a while. And the meeting starts, and one guy says to this other guy, and they're going up and down some stairs or steps or some damn thing. I didn't know what it was. There's 12 of these suckers anyway. And one old timer told one of the other ones, he says, if you don't get off that stair 5, you're going to get drunk. I'm thinking, so what? Like, good. Where is stair 5? Let's do that one first. Well, at the end of the meeting, this is the part that just killed me. They said, if you want what we have, and I look and they're bald and they're old, that's very attractive, right? I want to be 100 and never drink for the rest of my life. And I want one of those big fat stomachs, yes. And I want to be able to drink coffee until I wet myself standing up. If you want what I didn't know what they had, but I was sure as hell hoping I wasn't going to catch it. They said, you will go to any length to get it. And I thought, no, I won't. And I'm trying to remember, what were those choices? Oh, yeah, death, insanity, or this. Oh, God, give me death. I pick death. I never want this. And, of course, we went out to the car, and he said, how did you like the meeting? And I said, I loved it. That was great. I said, you know, Dwayne, I almost wish I was alcoholic, honest to God. That's great stuff you guys do in there. I'm glad you're doing it, you know. Go be someplace else. He dropped me off at the house, and I thought, well, that's that. See, Dwayne has this word in his vocabulary called sponsorship, whether you like it or not. He didn't wait around saying, would you be my sponsor? And he doesn't understand rejection well. So at 8 o'clock that night, he came to pick me up for another meeting. We go after this meeting, and there they are. 5 or 6 of the guys from the original meeting, a bunch of old ones, and a couple of girls. All right. Girls. Prostitutes, I figured. Well, and my reasoning went, here they are at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. No nice girl would, these must be hookers. So when they said, would anybody like to ask any questions, of course, I said, are you guys hookers? I know. And God spoke and said through Ruth's mouth, no, she said, we're not hookers. But, you know, once in a while we get really drunk in the bar and we pick up an anemic little puke like you. I hate the men and I hate the women in Alcoholics. Consistent, they're all weenies. How did you like the meeting? I said, I never want to go to another meeting with you or with those people again. Is that clear enough? He said, sure. What time do you want me to pick you up? You're not hearing me. I don't ever want to go to a meeting again. He said, so what? What's that got to do with anything, Marty? I don't want to go to a meeting. He said, I don't care what you want. You're too sick to make a decision. What? I have rights. He said, you had rights. You are alcoholic. Now we know for sure. I said, well, I'll have you pulled off my property. He said, you and whose army? And he said, I'll be there tomorrow night to pick you up for me. And I said, Dwayne, I don't want to go to any more meetings. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'll make you a deal. 90 days, 90 meetings, and then if you are not satisfied, we will refund your misery, and you can just go and die some other place. And I said, fine. And I mean, the alcoholic resentment kicks in. I can stay sober 90 days. Come on! And when I'm done, and you're done, you big Norwegian craphead, I will blow up your car, I will kill your dog that has no teeth, because this dog was so old it used to come out at you, and then it would forget to bark, you know. And I'm going to set your car on fire. And I was just thinking of all this stuff. Sort of like an acceptance speech of his sponsorship, you know. I hated him. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous for the first 90 days. And he used to phone me up with his inspirational little talks. One day the phone rang, and they used to phone me and they'd say, it's 7 o'clock. Get in a chair. Get the big book. Read page 62. And it would start off. And it would say, selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our problem. And they'd phone periodically to see if I was in the chair. Some of you know Stan C. from Saskatoon. Stan was the co-sponsor in this plot. And they used to play good guy, bad guy. You know, like one would just mysteriously show up and say the other one was didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, horrible people. One time they picked me up and they said, it's time to tell them. And I said, tell me what? They said, well, We wait until you're around at least 60 days, and then we tell you the truth. There is no God. I said, you're kidding. No God. That's just something we tell newcomers. Do you know, but by the time I got them back to their homes, I had both of them converted and believing in God. Yes. I would go, of course, opposite on any question. They knew that. I got my own faith that way. See? Dwayne used to phone up and he'd say, do you feel like drinking? I'd say, yes, I feel like drinking. He'd say, well, why don't I bring you over a beer? I'd say, that's a damn good idea. And then he said, I'm going to beat you up. And I'd say, what for? Well, he said, when you drink, you're going to get hurt. And I don't want you to get hurt by strangers. This is the loving fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the kind of loving crap you put up with if you're going to live. Now, I really didn't want what they had. And I was willing to go to any length not to get it. You see, my entire life had been a carbon opposite of your 12 steps. I did not admit that I was powerless over alcohol. I would never admit that my life had become unmanageable. I could not conceive or believe in the fact that any God or power outside of myself would ever again make me feel whole. Do you know why? Because you can't come back from a place you've never been. I had never felt all in one place all at the same time in my entire miserable little life. And so when they talked about restoring me to sanity, I thought, that's impossible. I've never been there. They talked about making a decision. I was committed to never making decisions. I'm schizophrenic, yes and no. Right. I could not turn my life and my will, my life, the things that I do and my will over to the care of what? There's no God. If there was a God, there would not be all this suffering. I had all the rationales, but at the bottom of it was, if there's a God, I'm going to be a crispy critter. And therefore, no God. And then they say that we make a list of our grosser handicaps in step four. Well, I want to tell you, I was not about to dredge up things from the past and suffer all that humiliation again. A moral inventory? I was a completely immoral person. I had done hundreds of hours of immoral inventories. See, a moral is a truth that you have inside yourself. And I, like the book said, had every truth that I knew plucked one by one out of me. Bill calls it incomprehensible demoralization. Incomprehensible means you can't even understand what's happened to you. And demoralization is when all your morals, all your truths are pulled away from you. And that's where I was. I got here with no truth. See, and then they said, you will admit this to another human being. And I thought, like hell. I am going to give some other person information on me like this, and then if there's a war and they want to make me a general or something, they won't do it. Because this nut's got all that information on me. Now, I'm not saying I was slightly maladjusted at this point, but maybe. And then it talked about having God remove my defects of character. I believed when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that if God took my defects of character, I'd disappear. I was a defect of character. See, and then it goes on to this, making apologies to people? I don't think so. What about them coming and apologizing to me? What about me? Now, there was an interesting subject, I thought. Most of the time. Why don't they have a step in there that says, people come to you and say they're sorry? That program I could work. And then they talked about continuing through prayer and meditation. I had a commitment. Never to meditate, because it screwed you up. It started all that fear again. And as far as prayer went, no way. To improve our conscious contact with this God of ours, and then to pray for what? The knowledge of His will? No, not me. Because if you really get the will of God, you know, you end up in Africa as a missionary. See, in fact, when Dwayne phoned one time and said, you're done step three. I said, I can't do step three. I'll end up in Africa as a missionary. He said, what the hell would they do with an idiot like you in Africa? Good point. Good point. See, and then it talked about having had a spiritual awakening. I had no spiritual sight left. I was black. And it was dark. As the result of not doing these steps, I had no spiritual sight. I was unable to carry any message to another human being. And I did not want to practice anything like a principle in any part of my life because it didn't fit. It scared me skinny. Because one day I'd be so good and then I'd lose and the next day I'd be so bad and I just couldn't seem to get into any part of that will. I was like a volleyball in my own life. Completely confused. You know? And I would sit at those meetings and sometimes you would start to attract me and I'd go, oh, boy, I don't want that. The guy that I admired the most in the cocktail lounge I used to drink in, shared the third or fourth meeting I went to. And I went there and I was amazed because here is this guy. He always looked so slick. He always wore $1,000 suits. He drove a Cadillac. He was like my hero. And I said, what are you doing at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And he said, I haven't had a drink for 6 months. I said, what did you quit for? Did you burp or something? He said, no, Marty. When I would leave the Sheraton Cavalier where you and I used to drink, I would go over to the Saskatoon Hotel and I'd crawl on my belly and puke and fight and miss work. I just didn't get drunk in front of my business associates, and I started to learn about actors, and I started to say just a little bit, maybe I want some of what they have. Because what they seemed to have, what I perceived they had that nobody else ever had, was this love thing. They seemed to honestly care for my spiritual well-being more than they cared that I would adhere to some silly thing that they thought was right. You know, they seemed to care about my kid, my wife. I mean, they really honestly seemed to care. And on the 90th day, I went to a meeting, and there was an old boy there from Florida, Palmetto Beach, Florida. Some of you will remember Wesley Parrish. And Wesley was really fat and really rich. I liked him. But, of course, I was into my hard rock AA kind of face, you know. I never reacted during his entire talk. I look just like some of you now. Had my arms crossed. I wasn't going to let him get me. I wasn't going to let him make me feel better, for Christ's sake. I don't want to feel better. I want to suffer. That's what I knew. It was safe in there. And so, Wesley finished. Everybody came to their feet. A bunch of people came to the podium. Wesley walked right off the podium, walked right up to me and said, what is bugging you, boy? And I said, you are bugging me. Because he was big enough, I knew I could beat him up. And he said, you get out into that parking lot, and I will be with you presently. And he came out there, and he ripped my mask. He talked about this sort of like consciousness that I'd always had. If you're an alcoholic tonight, and you're just on the edge of coming into this thing, and you have this other you that haunts you day and night, this thing that you know is right, you know, this person that you like that you can never ascend to be, that's what Wesley talked to me about. He didn't talk to me about drunk stories and being in jail, all these places I hadn't been. Wesley talked to me about connecting with who I actually was. And for the first time, I promise you, I had hope. Just a seed. Because when people said to me when I was 22 years old and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, what could you have lost at the age of 22 that would have made you quit drinking? And I said, I lost hope. I honestly came to believe that someone like me was beyond reach. And the ABCs were true. I was alcoholic. My life was unbelievable. No human power could seem to relieve my alcoholism. And I knew God could and would if he were sought. And I drove away that night and I said to that wife of mine, I think I'm going to stay 91, maybe 92, maybe even 100 days. And she was amazed. She didn't know you could ever drink again when she came to Alcoholics Anonymous. She thought once they had you, you were screwed. That's what Dwayne told her. She didn't know I even had a choice anymore. And I started going to the meetings. And you know, when you got hope, the next thing that comes is faith. Because I started to hear and I started to see these guys are not lying about their experience. This stuff really happened to them. If it can happen for them, perhaps it can happen for me. And just Bill says, just that little wedge of willingness. And of course, I went right from a drunk to a monk. I went right from spiritual blackness to not wanting them to swear anymore at the meetings. I could heal a religious record just picking it up, you know. Dwayne used to phone me and tell me dirty jokes on the phone all the time. I used to pray for him and forgive him. So spiritually minded, I was of no earthly good. And one night he picked me up and he said, I've got a spiritual tape I want you to hear. Because he says, yeah, I mean, you're really into this spiritual thing, aren't you? I mean, I was going to church 7 days a week. The church didn't even want me either. But anyway. The tape was a Canadian comedian by the name of Nestor Pister, and this guy is foul. I mean, just every word's a swear word. So I pulled the tape out of Dwayne's car and I broke it. And I had never seen this guy ever mad before. And he turned a sort of a blue. And that vein in the middle of his head started to physically move from one lobe to the other. I thought, man, I am dead. And of course, I'm so spiritual, I'm praying. And he said, listen, you better understand something, Jeffrey. He said, I have more spirituality in my ass than you have in your entire body. Well, this guy is getting hard to forgive. Yes. So I gathered myself up and I said, how do you know that? And he said, I'll tell you how I know that. Because God is a God of calm. It's a resting place. God is love and God is forgiveness, and you do not possess any of those things. All you possess is the will to make us all believe the way you believe. And he said, you know what? You have finally done it. You are free to go, buddy. Get out of the car and go and die. Kicked out of Alcoholics Anonymous. God, that was a long walk, those 4 or 5 blocks home. And I went to my church in the morning and I told them I'd been kicked out of AA. But that was probably good because now I could really get involved. And the guy said, you know, I've got to tell you something. He said, you see, when you're in church and I'm up there at the front and I'm doing a sermon, who's the audience? And I said, well, we are. The people are the audience. And he said, no, Marty, and that's what's wrong. That's wrong. That's what's wrong with everything that you think. He said, God is the audience. See, he said, I'm just like sort of leading the prayers and we're all gathering together to offer prayers to higher power. He's the audience. And I had one of those really deep spiritual shots in the gut, you know, it's go, boom, I knew for the first time. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now these guys were humble. They knew what had happened and I walked in the room and they said, hallelujah, the Lord is back among us. And this old boy who was sobering up when the earth's crust was cooling, Jeff, I walked by Jeff and he said, there but for the grace of God goes God. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has this promise, and that's that when the pupil is ready, the teacher will appear. Old Chuck C. used to say that from California, and I didn't know what he meant because I couldn't hear. But that day, I knew what that meant. And I was to talk at a conference that night, and I went into Winnipeg, and I had, all I could describe it to you is, it was like an LSD experience. When the speaker finished, the room just all went into colors and blurred, and I thought, oh my God, somebody's drugged me. You know? Remember that stuff? Hi! Hey! Ooh. So I ran across the street to the hotel where my wife and children were, and I slammed the door, and she said, what's wrong? And I shared with her, like most alcoholics do in recovery, I said, shut up. And I ran into the bathroom, and I got onto my knees, and I opened my big book, which I hadn't done forever, and it came open to page 82, and it said, your sobriety is contingent on the maintenance of your spiritual condition. And it went quiet. It was quiet. But I've already tried the church. I mean, I tried to become a right-hand man to God. It didn't work. Like, I'm confused. What do they mean? Spiritual condition. And again, God will reveal. I went back to my home group. You know, I'd quit my home group. And I sat at the back of the room and I shut up. And they started their stupid little book study. I knew the book upside down. And they started their stupid little book study. And they read stuff I had never heard before. God, or the AA fairy, one of the two, had rewritten the whole damn book while I was having my spiritual experience. But it talks about the spiritual experience that I was going to have on the 14th page, where Bill is in the hospital, Abby's on the edge of the bed, Bill has just finished his 5th, 6th, 7th steps. He was prepared to do 9. He and his friend talked, you remember? He said, my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all our affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others, as he had worked with me. Faith without works is dead. How appallingly true for the alcoholic. If you're having a rough time tonight, listen to this. For if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. He would surely drink, and if he drank, he would surely die. And then faith would be dead. Indeed, for us alcoholics, it is just like that, you see. So your spiritual condition is talking to them empty-headed new drunks, and some of the empty-headed old drunks too. I think like Alcoholics Anonymous says, you come in here and they issue you this wonderful kite, and whoo, up you go. And you glide way above all them old drunks, and you look down at those pathetic, battered up kites they got, and you think to yourself, this is better than drinking. Now I'll just do a few really spiritual maneuvers here. And the next thing you know, whack, you stick in the rocks. And you can't go up and you can't come back down. You are just hung. And you see them damn old-timers go over you. Start to hate them old-timers. You know, I remember when I knew more than they did. And one day one of those old farts comes down in that battered-up kite, turns sideways, comes through that hole in the rocks, grabs your kite, takes you back into the air, and you bump along that AA landscape for a while. Bang, 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 bang. And you figure, if I could just manage this kite better, I know I could fly higher than that old fart. Bang, bang. And one day, in absolute desperation, you say, ah, screw it. Up you go. Right at their level. And you start looking for new people in the rocks. You see, sobriety is so much to do, paradoxically, with dying to self and crucifying that old person and letting go of that kite so that higher power can lift you and give you words you don't have to say to people you've never met. Like the night I went on the 12-step call and I wasn't taking anybody with me because I didn't like sharing newcomers. I can get greedy about anything. It was the biggest Canadian Indian I had ever seen in my entire life. Huge! Big shoulders. They're usually not like that. This guy was, you know, those flat pecs like you see in those pukey little guys in those beer commercials. Just like that. And I sat down and out of my mouth I hear these words. How long have you hated being Indian? Holy cow! Oh my God! Why would I say that? I'm dead! Why would... Oh, I wish I'd have brought somebody. Jeez. I'm going to get beat up so bad. He started to cry. His name is Fred. He's recovered now 15, 16 years. I don't know. Every time I see, I could be in a room like this, Fred could walk in and he'd start to cry. He's like my banker. He cries every time he sees me. He has done more for his people. He has done more with his life than some of us will ever do, because that was at the center, the root of what was wrong, and God spoke through my mouth when I wasn't controlling. I wasn't trying to be slick. I wasn't trying to say the right thing. Just out it came. And it's happened every time I've gotten out of the way. that a power greater than myself teaches me to handle situations that used to baffle me, to intuitively know what to say. And so if you're one of those people in the room tonight who would get recovered except you don't have any 12-step genes, like you're just not good at it, I would like to introduce you to one of the worst. He's almost a phenomenon in how bad he is at 12-stepping. Bill Wilson. See, from the time he left the hospital until he met Dr. Bob, I figured it out one day, he had made somewhere around 600 12-step calls, not one recovery. And even Bob got drunk after he met with him. This guy should have quit. And it was the first time Al-Anon ever spoke to Alcoholics Anonymous through Lois. Because Bill said, this isn't working. And she said, I beg to differ. You are sober for 6 months. I beg to differ. It is working very well. And so we see that Alcoholics Anonymous... Thank you. Yep. That's for Al-Anon. Alcoholics Anonymous and our wonderful 12-step program is to do with giving, even when you don't understand why you're doing what you're doing. Don't figure it out. I always say, get stupid, get a prize. If we could figure this out, we would quit. If we could figure this out, it would no longer be the mysterious set of coincidences and miracles that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. We can't figure it out. It is good that you don't know what you're doing. Once you don't know what you're doing, then you know what you're doing. Any old timer will tell you that. And the longer you stay, the dumber you get. Is that true? Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship. That just means that we are brothers and sisters and we love one another. Of men and women who just share with each other. I used to be so I couldn't speak in Alcoholics Anonymous at a meeting without trying to deliver the epistle from the mound. And by the time they were around the table, I was so wound up I'd say, pass. I didn't know some people needed to hear that I was having a bad day. This other people needed to hear that I had some progress in my day. That it was just for me to give my little book report, and they would have to understand that the way they understood that it had nothing at all to do with me. It's just my father saying, freely have you received, so shall you give. And then you wait for a prize. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me this privilege, and it's in the book again, that I get everything that I need. And when I get what I need, invariably, I find out it's what I wanted. You see, I never, ever thought I could stand here and feel the love for a bunch of strangers that I feel for you. I thought that was nonsense and crap and unnecessary and emotional, like an emotional orgy, sickening. I heal from you. There is a mystery in this thing. I have never been to a meeting. Sometimes intellectually I can't follow the topic, but when I leave, spiritually something has happened. When I'm listening to these fifth steps that we do one with the other in Manitoba, and I'm thinking, I don't know any answers for this. I don't understand. I don't have any experience in this area. And God just speaks and I say, wow. Every time I just relax, higher power takes care of me. Marty, when are you going to just totally relax? See, there's an old boy from Virginia and he said it better than anybody I know. He said, if you love everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, you are not going to enough meetings. I would correct that by saying, if you like everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're probably not going to enough meetings. But when you realize that all we wish for one another is an improvement in the spiritual condition, then you are immediately in love with everybody in the room, because that is what love is all about. And that is the thing that will give you that spiritual dimension, that will bring your kite out of the rocks. And if you're 6 years sober or seven or wherever you're at, that's usually the place where this seems to happen. And you're stuck on the wall again and those crappy newcomers are all talking to the old timers. And you're a middle member and you don't know where you fit or what you're doing here and you're thinking about resigning. Think again. You see, it's not what I get. It's what I give. Good night.